Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on Tuesday. Let's call it Janet Yellen Tuesday. She just spoke in New York, and John Najarian is on a phone line from you can watch John on CNBC. Follow him on Twitter at John Najarian, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the Business Lunch, John.
Great to be with you, Stephen. Thank you.
All right. Did Janet Yellen give you a lot to digest for lunch, or maybe not so much? I'm not sure what's there.
I would say not so much, but people have been looking for the mixed messages that are coming out of the Fed that maybe start coalescing into one solid policy. and hopefully with the chairman coming out and saying to the New York Economic Club or the Economic Club of New York City as strongly as she did that they're not necessarily on track for multiple rate increases this year. That it is still going to be data-driven. That's, you know, the catchphrase that she always uses, Stephen. But nonetheless, the tone was certainly not hawkish. And the fact that it was more of that dovish tone, I think, is why you saw the markets react the way they have so far.
Well, they jumped up a bit, right? And they seem to have given up about half of their gain after her remarks.
True. It's no guarantee that just because she's not saying that we need to see higher rates immediately, that the market should just get off and run. However, I think it's still more of what Mario Draghi at the European Central Bank has done, not just what he's said, but the fact that he's made interest rates much lower for much longer means that it's going to be very difficult for the U.S. or anybody else to decouple from that, and it'll basically give more ammunition to the crowd that's really looking for that investment that will work even in that very low for very long interest rate environment.
All right, there's Janet Yellen speaking to the Economic Club of New York. I want to ask you as well, John, about a couple of other stocks. Apple, for one.
Sure.
You know, they've got this case resolved now. I don't know if it's resolved in the way that they would like, because the government seems to say that they've figured out a way into the iPhone without this fix they'd asked for from Apple, which you would think would be bad news for Apple. I mean, what's it look like on Wall Street today?
I think the Wall Street reaction is about what you would hope for. I'm not somebody who thinks that they shouldn't offer every bit of help that they can to unlock a cell phone that was used by the terrorists in the San Bernardino attacks. However, as you and I have discussed for the last several weeks, we thought there were a number of fixes, if you will, or ways to get into that phone beyond just opening up a back door so that everybody's phone would constantly be listened to by the Fed, or by the NSA, which may be doing it already, or the FBI and various police forces around the country. I think that this Israeli company that hacked this particular San Bernardino terrorist phone is more than capable of hacking into any Apple phone, and I think there are probably scores of other people who are capable of doing that. So rather than just having an open door, which is what Mr. Cook did not want to provide, I think this is the next best solution. Rather than that open door, just individual one-off cases, whether Apple grants and offers that or whether they are just done by a company like this Israeli company, it seems like we got to the right solution regardless.
And we know now that it can be done with or without Apple, which probably isn't so reassuring to the Apple stockholders and maybe the consumers, if they watch that closely on that.
Right. I think overall, many of them felt, as I did, though, Steve, that if Apple, after making its strong case, were to have caved, I think that could have adversely affected the stock. But I think because the stock is drifting higher again, I think this is a sign that people know that these things can be opened. They would just prefer that they're not constantly open and that the hack is more or less a one-off event.
So everyone sort of walks away, none the worse for wear on this. Tell me,
I think so.
Tell me about Facebook, too, because this is the day that Oculus Rift is going out in the mail, available to consumers. This is the new, the 3D headset, or the virtual reality headset. You know, that's the future of our worlds, but it's been met with mixed reviews. So Facebook owns them. I don't know how Facebook is doing today.
Facebook has been breaking out the last few days. We bought a bunch, knock on wood, for our customers last week, and the stock has been moving higher. It was back then it was 111.50 a share, and it's moved through 115, I believe, today. I like it. I don't like it for the virtual reality headset. I mean, I think that's a fine reason, but that's not the reason we liked it. We liked it for how well they're doing with video ads and how they're monetizing and growing that base of users through things like their acquisition of not just Instagram, but WhatsApp. I think the more that they can expand their universe, clearly the lead that they have will extend. And that's one of the reasons that, unfortunately for Twitter, Twitter suffers as much as it does, Steve. They just haven't found a way to do the same.
I'm a Twitter guy, but we're losing. Real quick, do you have a stock tip for us this week?
Well, today we were buying a lot of Amazon.com. That is another stock that looks like it has broken out on the charts. And so the stock was down about 12% year-to-date, and it's up about 4% on the month of March, that is. Otherwise, it would be down 16%. So, in other words, I think it's already had its correction, and yet they seem to be doing almost everything right. So we bought some of that. It was moving up nicely today, and hopefully that trend continues, Steve.
Excellent. John Najeri, and thanks very much for joining us today, John.
Likewise. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
Back to Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch here on WGN Radio.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael Heidemann. Steve Bertrand here, and it is a Tuesday afternoon. In the studio is Andrew Herman from DNA Info Chicago. And, you know, Andrew always brings in a few stories to talk about, but today I think we're just going to feast on this one. There's a great story on DNA Info up today. It's on my Facebook page as well. It's Steve Bertrand, about the oldest pizza joints in the city of Chicago.
It's really great. This is written by Janet Fuller. She's the food writer at DNA Info. People might remember her from the Sun-Times, but she dug in deep on this one, and it is really fascinating.
And it's a nice story because it's one of those, I mean, I think lists sometimes are clickbait to see where everything is. I learned so much about so many different, we're not going to get through all 10, but that's okay.
Right. I mean, as we were saying, it seems like pizza's been around forever, but really it hasn't. It really only showed up in Chicago in the, you know, in the 30s and really took off in the really post-war.
Right. So the first one is Granado's Pizza, was the first pizza joint in the 1930s on Taylor Street.
Right.
And they advertised their round pizza.
Uh-huh. As opposed to the square pizza, I guess.
Right.
But, yeah, so that started, and that was in, you know, the old Little Italy area, and then it hung around there, and then they built the University of Illinois at Chicago, Circle Campus, as they used to call it.
Right.
Yeah. And out it went with a lot of other old Little Italy establishments. But that was sort of the front line.
And reading the story, I didn't realize that pizza early on was just sort of something, it was like bar food. It was like the bowls of pretzels and mixed nuts they put out now. They would put these pieces out and people would eat them, and then finally they realized, hey, we can make a living selling this stuff.
Right. When you look at the list of the oldest pizza places on the DNA Info website, you can see a lot of them started really as taverns.
Right.
And they were just trying to figure out, you know, how do I distinguish my tavern from the one on the corner and the one next to that one, and, you know.
It would be years before the Tombstone Pizza Oven would make their way into those taverns.
That's right. They had to make them fresh, and so all the taverns were trying to figure out different ways to attract business, and pizza took off.
All right, the oldest pizza joint still alive, still living, still open, I should say, is Pizzeria Uno.
Right, very
which
famous
we all know.
Place. Yeah, 29 East Ohio.
And with the story from there, I didn't know is that that's where we got Ricardo's. Ricardo's was a famous journalist hangout at Rush and Wabash for years and years. No, Rush and, that's right here.
Right,
Illinois.
Right behind the Wrigley Building.
Right, right.
Yeah. So they started in 1943. First of all, at the beginning, they were just called Pizzeria. And that, I guess, was probably unique enough where
there weren't many around.
That's right. And then they changed it to Pizzeria Ricardo, which was named after one of the partners, Rick Ricardo. And then it became Pizzeria Uno. And then we got Due after that.
So they're the oldest. I want to skip down the line now to another one where I used to eat all the time was Pat's Pizza. And I can remember working here when I'd be working Saturday nights. And Pat's would deliver. I'd get a pizza, you know, and they're down in Lakeview. I think they were in a basement off Halstead or Sheffield. And there was a little family feud there decades ago, and that's where Leona's restaurants come from.
Right. So that's at 2679 North Lincoln, opened in 1950. And as you say, there was a little family squabble, and I guess we're all better off for it because it gave us the Leona's chain.
Yeah. And so it's really a part of Chicago history. Another one that I didn't know of, this one in the 8400 block of South Pulaski, Vito and Nick's. Which sounds like it's a real original.
Yeah, that's number two. Opened in 1945. The pizza was created by Vito's wife, Vita Baracco's wife, Mary. And she created a very thin style pizza, which is always good. And in describing the place, Jenna Fuller, our writer, talks about how they have old style on tap and carpet on the walls, which makes me want to go there.
Right. And she said, you know, you're local if you order the old style. That's how they know.
That's right.
I don't know where the carpet comes into play there. I'm not sure I want
to
know.
It used to be a thing.
Yeah. And then there was one other one I wanted to talk about, and it's Home Run Inn Pizza.
Yeah.
So Home Run Inn, you know, they... Well, there's so you got to read this story. It's at DNA Info, but it's on my Facebook page as well. But I didn't realize they got their name because they were across from a baseball park, and the balls kept going through their windows.
Right. Yeah. You know, I didn't realize that either. It's such a famous name in Chicago. The original's at 4254 West 31st Street, opened in 1947, third oldest, and now they have 8 and soon to be 9 different locations. But boy, you go into any grocery store in Chicago, and there's Home Run Inn Pizza, frozen pizza, and it's great.
And Janet writes in this piece about where the frozen pizza sort of came from Home Run Inn. We're out of time, Andrew. And you didn't bring any pizza in. What's going on?
You're always tweeting out that I'm bringing food. I'm never bringing food.
You can read the story at dnainfo.com or on my Facebook page. That's Steve Bertrand. Great to see you again.
All right.
You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's 12:38 on Tuesday afternoon. Suzanne Mushin is in the studio as well. She's the co-host of The Big Payoff. You should listen to that podcast. It's at WGNplus.com, and she brings issues in generally when it comes to women in the workplace or career issues, right?
That's right, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And I can't believe this one has taken this long to get to our guest.
We try to avoid this.
You try to avoid it?
Well, no, I think you and I try to avoid politics in general. Kind of.
Right. Okay. So here it's the First Wives Club on the Republican Party. And
right.
It started in Utah where this super PAC affiliated with Ted Cruz, right, comes out with these.
Which you have to just give them some creds for the name of the super PAC.
What is it?
Make America Awesome.
Make America Awesome.
Thinly veiled. Thinly veiled, yes.
And so they put out these ads to sway Mormon women.
Correct.
Predominantly. That Melania is not. Fit. Well, fit's the wrong word.
Right. Right. Not perhaps socially or intellectually
acceptable.
Fit.
She
right.
certainly is fit to be the first lady.
Correct.
And basically, they're nude shots of
yep.
her.
Lying on a rug, shall we say.
Right. And they were in GQ. But she's posing nude.
Yes.
Just not fully exposed.
Right.
And then Donald Trump responds by saying, Melania is wonderful, and who would you rather have as first lady? And then he posts this unflattering picture of Heidi Cruz.
A side-by-side, right.
Right. And that's got you all aflutter.
Look, this is now par for the course in this election, right? So on the one hand, you can say, well, yeah, these guys have been at it for this long. It's got to come to this kind of bullying tactic. But here's where I have the problem. We are now using these women as objects. We're really no longer talking about Heidi Cruz and Melania Trump as women, as people. I mean, I actually did not know. You said before the show that you did. Heidi Cruz is an MBA from Harvard.
Right.
Successful businesswoman. Melania Trump speaks 3 languages. These are fully formed. Wait, why are you laughing at that?
I'm not laughing at that.
She really does. No, English is probably the worst of the three.
Yeah, no, I'm not laughing at that.
Okay.
Because it's just amazing to me that we are so hard on immigrants who can speak three or four languages.
Three languages,
those of us who
right?
can only speak one.
Exactly.
And sometimes not even so well.
So ethnocentric. But the reality is these are fully formed women with real careers. Okay, fully
Stop.
Formed. Steve rolled his eyes. You all missed it. I caught it. This is an unfortunate state of the conversation that we've gotten to, where the women are really being treated like objects. And that's, I think, what's wrong with the conversation. We're talking about Mrs. Cruz and Mrs. Trump as if they're not actually human beings.
Okay, but isn't that the role of the political spouse?
Oh, generally? My God. What do you mean to take this kind of objectifying?
No, but they're always are in the shadow of the person running. Now it's almost always been
True.
A woman in the shadow of the man, and in this case, in the Clinton case, it's a little
Mr.
different
because
he was present. But Mr. Carly, he was
True.
Certainly a shadow of her.
That's a choice, and I agree with that completely, that's a choice the women are making to be that role relative to their husband. But just because they're playing that role doesn't mean that they actually aren't three-dimensional human beings.
Right.
I mean, if your wife goes with you, Steve, to a WGN event, and you are clearly there in your role as the host of this show, she can stand by your side and be supportive without being all of a sudden an object that people can just utilize as if she doesn't actually have a full life herself.
Okay. Heidi Cruz is very well, I think, respected. In fact, she spoke at the City Club here in Chicago ahead of the Illinois primary. And
she's smart.
She's very smart. And
yeah.
a guy I know who was there came back and said the wrong Cruz is running.
Well,
so,
that's been said about many first ladies. Right, including the current president.
I can't think of any.
Oh, come on. Michelle Obama for president is like the most trending hashtag. But.
So I think she does get her cred. I think I'm not completely with you on this
one. I think in this case, we have gone so far off road that I wish that were true. I think it's a tiny, tiny group of people who will really wake up and say, oh, Heidi Cruz, yeah, she's that smart financial wizard.
Where is it? Goldman Sachs? Is that where she worked?
Yeah. Yes.
So she got a little hot water because of her accomplishment and access,
right.
because her husband got a $1 million loan
right.
from Goldman Sachs. So that's been out there.
Yeah. I would still say she's at this moment, if you ask for the definition of Heidi Cruz, there's no MBA after that title. MRS is what we see.
On the other hand, posing nude and dancing or doing whatever you want can be a sign of individual empowerment.
Are we really going here?
It's not,
where are you going with this?
It's not first lady behavior.
No, that's
and
not
so
right.
She
wasn't first lady when she took those pictures.
Okay, but she's a person who, I don't know where I'm going.
I don't know where you can go with that, honestly, because I would think that is 100% true if that were occurring now or even within the last 6 months leading up to this campaign.
Do you think it's fair for opponents of him to say, hey, this is a woman who poses nude and she's going to be your first lady? Think about that.
No, it's a ridiculous argument.
Really? I'm not sure I think that's true.
Because she did that in her past. Now we're going back to like the Vanessa Williams who got kicked off of her title of being Miss America because she had a nude photo. Come on. I mean, Putin walks around with his shirt off riding horses, and we're okay,
being the leader. We are not okay.
Well, the world has not suggested.
And being Miss America is very different from being the first lady. I don't know. I think that's something that will, well, not this year. Nothing resonates with voters.
It's a good conversation.
Yeah.
It's also interesting. Last night I was hosting an event for Women's History Month, and there was a woman there who was from Sweden, and she said, we don't really have these issues in Sweden. There is no first lady role. It's just
right.
not a role.
Oh, really?
No.
So what are they?
They're the wives of the candidates. They're not really trying themselves to be some,
So they're not out there campaigning either.
Not at all.
Right.
You never see them.
Right. So it's not altogether pure here because we do use them that way.
Oh, we do.
But they use themselves too.
Absolutely. But I think the question we can raise is in 2016, the role of the first lady, does it need to be rethought, rebranded, reimagined in light of women's new roles in society?
Yeah. Well, I think it's been changing, don't you think? I mean,
it were changing more.
Really? What would you have Michelle Obama do differently?
I think that Michelle has been very She's been kept in a particular area of concern around obesity issues, really still related to children, spouses of veterans, families. She hasn't really been allowed. For example, when Hillary Clinton did her whole thing on health care, she was slammed because I think that was the boys' club. But sure, you can do children's stuff, fat and obesity.
Right.
That's a woman's
issue. Well, another
part
of that is I don't disagree with you completely, but it's also true that the health care was a major institutional change in government.
Yes.
And she wasn't elected.
No, that 100%, right? But I think that's not the argument. People basically said, you simply have no right, Mrs. whomever, Clinton, to be talking about this.
Okay. I don't know if I completely agree with you there. Because she was not some Tammy Wynette standing by her man.
No, she ultimately did stand by her man.
Suzanne, she did. You're right. Suzanne Muchen is the co-host of The Big Payoff. Listen to it on WGNplus.com. Thanks for coming
in. Thanks, Steve. You going to post those photos? I kind of dared you to.
Michael Heidman's taking of us? Oh, you mean of Melania?
No. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if we pull out a rug, sure, we could do that, just like the muffin photos. People will go crazy.
I'm not sure where you're going here. I'm just going to stop and let you keep talking.
Okay.
We'll be back.
We'll be back.
It's the Business Lunch. Thank you, Orrin. It's 12:53 here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Okay, sometimes studies just jump out of me, and I don't know what I was expecting with this one, but I thought it would tell me something. I looked over the numbers. It's a Wallet Hub study, and I'm still not sure I understand it. So Jill Gonzalez is on a phone line to help us sort this out. Jill, welcome to the Business Lunch again.
Thanks for having me back.
Nice to have you back. Okay, so you guys looked at credit scores, and is there a correlation between credit scores and the presidential candidates that are supported? So let's say people with bad credit, would they all gravitate to one candidate more than another? Okay. My thinking before I read the study is that the people with bad credit would be more likely to support Donald Trump than any other candidate. And I say that because the people who, and maybe Bernie Sanders too, the people who are behind Donald Trump, you know, they're angry. Things aren't going their way. Globalization hasn't worked for them. They've sort of been under the boot heel of the economy. So maybe bad credit. That's what I was expecting, but that's not what the numbers really showed, was it?
No, it wasn't. It's interesting. So credit can actually tell you a lot about a person, about a demographic. And you're right, bad credit can either mean one of two things for the most part. The first is what you said, you know, things aren't going your way. Either you have not fully recovered from the recession, you still might have some bankruptcy, some not so good things, foreclosure possibly on your credit report that's pulling down your score. Or you could be very new to credit, very young, just out of college. And that's, I think, where we see some of this kind of disconnect. So we actually saw that Hillary Clinton had the most supporters with bad credit, just over 25%. And that's the most of any candidate. By the way, we did this when there were six candidates, if you can imagine. A couple have dropped out.
Right. Does that mean 25% of her supporters have bad credit, or 25% of the people with bad credit support her?
25% of her supporters
have bad credit. Okay.
But then she's followed by Bernie Sanders, 22%, and then, like you said, Donald Trump at 20%.
Yeah, but Donald Trump's not so far. I mean, 20% is, I mean, that's what, 25% better than Hillary Clinton. So he's certainly trailing when it comes to Hillary Clinton on those numbers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, go ahead.
It looks different for excellent credit scores or good credit scores. Oftentimes, that equates to an older demographic, right, because the length of credit history and number of credit lines available do play probably the most important parts in your scores. And usually, those people who are wealthier, who are well off, do end up having higher credit scores.
So that makes sense then. So it would be John Kasich. John Kasich, who probably does well among the older Republicans. He's got the most supporters with good credit score, 59, almost 60%. Then comes Marco Rubio. I'm not sure I understand Marco Rubio. And then Ted Cruz. So the Republicans are doing pretty well when it comes to people with good credit as compared to the Democrats.
That's exactly right. So we all said they're upwards of 50%, almost 60%, whereas the Democrats are kind of just wavering around the 50% mark of having excellent credit. Bernie is at 51%. Hillary, almost 51%.
All right. So I don't know if we have time to do. Can you do it very quickly? Then you also looked at people who believe in global warming and how that compares to their credit scores. Can you summarize that for me?
Yeah, this was more of a surprise. So we asked about climate change, what people believe in. No surprise here, 97% of Bernie Sanders and 96% of Hillary Clinton supporters do believe in it. But 50% of Ted Cruz supporters and 65% of Donald Trump supporters also believe in climate change, which we thought were very high numbers.
Right. So it seems to be that the populace is ahead of the candidates in some cases when it comes to climate change.
Absolutely. So we thought that those numbers, especially for the Republicans, would be a lot lower. So it's
right.
Interesting to see what people are really going to be paying attention to when it comes to voting.
So I suppose it just shows us the population is ahead of the candidates on so many things, especially this cycle, because no one is getting what they expected. Jill Gonzalez writes for Wallet Hub. She's an analyst there. And I appreciate you joining us today, Jill.
Anytime.
I look forward to the next time. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.